Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 29th, 2017, and welcome to episode 146 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and staying sane. So, you know, welcome to this one-dimensional table.
Well, then I'm in the right place.
Yes. So I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and joining me today is Carrington Vanston in... are you in Toronto?
I am in Toronto, yes.
Okay, so normally in Toronto, and... now, also in Toronto. How are you doing?
Continuing to be in Toronto. Or Toronto, as we say it locally. Just the one T. I'm doing great. I stand here on this side of the border watching what's happening on that side of the border with an increasing despair on my face.
Yes, yes.
But hey, what can you do? Welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, I think we can all just hunker down and try to retro compute.
Retro compute.
But, yes, yeah, no, it's been an eventful week, as I record, and you know, what is it, the old curse, may you have an interesting life?
Let's right.
Hope for many fewer interesting weeks.
Yes. I'd like a far less interesting life.
Yes. Okay, so...
So it's just the two of us. We're going to do a little two-hander, just Paul and I, but you have come up with you're a host, so you've come up with a topic, and we'll discuss it.
Yeah. So we'll see where this goes. But my idea was the next new old thing. So what I was thinking was that we are in this, you know, we have some background, whatever. Actually, we have a fairly similar background to you and I. But so we're kind of experts on something. And so we're familiar with something, you know, maybe programming the Apple II in BASIC or whatever. But part of the fun of the hobby is kind of seeing what else there is out there that we didn't get involved in. And with our new... you know, our new modern brains, what kinds of things do we want to turn those new modern, you know, powerful adult brains to see what, you know, what we didn't know at the time, what we didn't learn at the time. So I was thinking things like Forth and COBOL or game engines or alternative platforms or mainframes. So I have a million possible things to say, but I'll stop talking for a second, and we can go back and forth with our ideas.
Well, for me, the first one that came to mind is something I wanted to learn back in the day, has basically been on my to-do list for a good 30 years, which is 6502 assembly language. I know a tiny bit. I have done a teeny tiny bit of it. I understand the concept of opcodes. I have gone through a little bit of, you know, tutorials and written a few things, but I in no way have really grokked it, and I haven't produced anything end-to-end in assembly. And it's something I've wanted to do in particular related to doing something on the Apple II, specifically like arcade games or something that would take advantage of the speed I could get from doing something in assembly. I got very close to, you know, finally firing up a project a few years ago, but then unfortunately got caught up in that wave of, hey, look at all these great, easy ways to compile stuff now. Why don't you just write things in C and stay lazy, Carrington? And I said, yes, I shall. And so, like, the existence of compilers just let me stay comfortable and stick with C languages. And so it's still on my list. It's still something I'd like to do. And it's an itch that I'm getting closer to wanting to scratch, I think. So in particular, I want to do, and I have some ideas for arcade games, for the Apple II, just something simple and basic to, or but not in basic, to, you know, stretch my muscles a bit. And in particular, a skill set I'd like to learn for the Apple II that I don't have is blitting. I mean, I understand memory moving, but any arcade sprite work I've ever done in like any old computers at all, I was relying on the kindness of sprite engines and player missile graphics and computers that had those things available. And then I just got out of arcade game writing. So there's none of that for the Apple II. If you want sprites, you're gonna blit them yourself. And that's something I haven't done. Again, I get the concept. I just haven't actually executed. And so that means maybe I don't really understand it. So that was the first thing that jumped to mind, was 6502 assembly language, specifically with arcade game production for the Apple II.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm a little bit more familiar with that, I think, but it is something that I would like to do myself as well. Like you had set up, I think, I don't know, you're right, it's like 3 years ago or maybe more, this Xcode pipeline.
Oh, yeah, except that wasn't mine. Like, I remember I was kind of the person, I think I did a thing at Kansas Fest, but even then I was saying, hey, did anybody notice that this stuff all exists? Like, there was basically lying around for the use, essentially a pipeline. And then people who are better than me, Quinn and stuff, said, well, hold on, we could do this better. We could actually put together a package. So all I contributed really was to notice that the various bits and bobs existed to make it actually pretty simple to go from plain text file to compiled, you know, program. And I just kind of pointed it out to people who then ran with it. But it made me lazy. It made me lazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've tried that out. So I think if I recall this correctly, you did the presentation and then like Quinn managed to get it down to a smaller number of keystrokes you needed to make it go.
I was still typing make like a savage. She's like, have you used Xcode? Yeah, I use it every day, all the time. So you think it would have occurred to me, but whatever.
Yeah. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the sort of most advanced fork of this is Jeremy Rand's, the Apple II build pipeline. But yeah, so I've installed that, and I actually have used it. I mean, you can use it to do assembly as well. So that's actually the only thing I've used it for. I don't feel like I know C very well. So yeah, no, I think I would kind of like to use that in order to try to write some things for the Apple III, because, you know, pretty much nothing is written in assembly on that. And the good thing about the 6502, actually, too, is that it is such a big, you know, it has such a big footprint, you know, so what you write can probably be moved over to, like, the Atari or the Commodore. Would you ever want to do that?
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, I still have my Atari 800 that I love very much, so, mm-hmm. I mean, could do that. But the for me, the thing that calls me is some sort of assembler game programming, right, for the Apple II. Not necessarily that I would become, you know, go full Martin Hay, where, you know, you no longer even see the matrix. It's like just the numbers, you see the games, just pluck them from the, like, just, you know, I'm not expecting to get to that kind of level. I just would like to produce something end-to-end in assembly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's true that it's an interesting challenge, you know, to do it on the Apple, because because it doesn't give you any support. I mean, you know, you just have to do as much as you can in that 1 megahertz that you've got.
Right. Yeah. And so what about you? So what was the thing that first jumped to your mind that you would use your new modern brain for to learn or go back?
Well, there are many, many, you know, sort of projects of this sort. One thing that did occur to me is, you know, a similar kind of thing, but with the Z80. So, and CPM generally, I never really kind of got into CPM, and so I'm only kind of vaguely familiar with how to use it. But it, you know, I know it's available on all these computers. You know, it's a very cross-platform thing. So it would be kind of neat to be able to write something that would work on all those computers. So I think that and Pascal also. I feel like I kind of skipped over Pascal. I went from, you know, basic to to 6502 machine language, then, you know, sort of passed through Pascal briefly and then went to C. As soon as the Pascal I would have used if I had really tried to write any Mac applications, because the interface was all Pascal.
And that's why I learned it, was I did a lot of early Mac development, and that I did a lot of that in Pascal.
Right, right. And I think I looked down at Pascal. It seemed like, you know, It seemed like the toy language of students or something, you know, like C was the professional language. So, but yeah, I mean, all of these things, like, I'm kind of curious about Forth, because it's such a weird language in comparison to the other ones. So that's one I'd like to learn. I don't have much application for it. I guess there are a couple of computers that I guess it was widely used, but somewhere just recently I saw some reference to the joke of, you know, if you've seen one version of Forth, you've seen one version of Forth. Because they're all different. But
see, Forth doesn't appeal to me at all. Didn't then, doesn't now, whatever. One thing that's on in our notes here on your list that you threw out as an idea that does appeal to me is inform. Mm-hmm. So going dragging things to the modern world, the idea of creating a text adventure game has massive appeal to me. But I seem to spend all my time instead working on text adventure game engines. So I never actually write a game. I just work on unfinished parsers. And I have, like many programmers, a penchant for doing that. That I will, instead of working on a blog, I will work on a CMS engine. And it's easy to fall down those rabbit holes and never actually produce anything, just make increasingly incomplete versions of tools. And I have fallen down that hole for, it's gotta be like a decade now. And I have nothing to show for it. And I have no text adventure game to show for it. And I think my time would be better spent instead actually trying to produce something in an existing engine. And Inform seems like the one that would appeal to most if I want to make an old school type adventure game, and gives me a nice big range of systems on which to deploy it, although not on the Apple II, which is the one thing that I would really like to do as well, unfortunately. But Inform and the idea of using that to create a retro style text adventure is another thing that really appeals to me as a potential next new old thing.
Actually, and I didn't realize that Inform couldn't be run on an Apple II. Is it? It's too advanced a game engine.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. It's, by the way, I think I'm not sure if we said this, but it's the at least is a descendant of the Infocom Z machine, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm really only familiar with Inform 6 and then more recently 7, if I've got those numbers correct. What I mean by which is the one that was around right when I started getting interested, and then the current one, which I believe is 7. And it may very well be the case that old versions of Inform could actually, you know, they're going to work with a Zen Machine file or something that is old enough it would deploy to an Apple II. I don't know. Hopefully somebody will write in and let me know if I'm wrong about that. But I'm pretty sure, at least when I looked into the tools that are available at the moment, if I want to work on a modern Mac and create this, then I will not be able to deploy to a vintage Apple II.
Yeah, and it sort of seems like it's almost the point. I mean, there's a creative aspect to interactive fiction in general, but it has to run on an Apple II.
Well, yes, except there's a pretty thriving ecosystem at the moment. Not, you know, purchasing ecosystem, but enjoying ecosystem for interactive fiction, though it has branched into more and more different and esoteric and strange sort of games. And you know, people just want to do more with them than you necessarily could, I guess, back when you were deploying to a 1 megahertz 8-bit computer. But that traditional text adventure that has very few demands other than cardinal directions and picking up items and puzzle solving is what appeals to me at its heart for a text adventure. Like that is the kind of game I'd like to create. So because of that, I would prefer to be able to deploy to an Apple II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other sort of aspect of this that I was, you know, thinking about as I was typing in the topic was that I have this kind of, I don't know if it's hubris, you know, arrogance or something that makes me think that, you know, now that I live in a world where computers are everywhere, you know, my phone, you know, my watch or whatever is just, you know, much fancier than any of the computers of the 80s. It should be simple. Like all those things that were difficult and challenging to our brains in the 80s should now be simple and obvious. I'm sure that is false. you know, I think that before there were kind of standards and everybody did things the same way, you know, you had to learn even more different kinds of like idiosyncrasies. So I think mainly I didn't really have much to say about that, only that I realized that I'm going to have to get over that attitude, because if I'm going to try to learn something like, you know, how to program in CPM or something, it's not like it's going to be easier for me now than it would have been just after having learned how to program assembly, you know.
I think it will be easier. I think maybe the concepts and stuff won't be easier, but the access to tools, the access to speedy compilers, the access to YouTube video how-tos and the support systems and stuff, like the access to all the solved problems and what their solutions ended up being has got to make it easier, which just means it's all the more pathetic when I fail. So that I still haven't got a game out there. Well, then just how embarrassing for me, because like all this is now given to me and I sit on my throne of privilege, and yet still I have no arcade game to show for it. I have no text adventure to show for it. Such is my life. And at some point I got to look in the mirror and think, maybe it's not the tools. It might just be that guy. So,
or it's the mirror.
Or it could be, that's what I mean, that guy, not this guy, that guy. But, you know, they say, like, they put people on the moon with computers far less powerful than my phone. And I have my phone, and I still couldn't put someone on the moon. So it's not just about the technology. There may actually be some skill sets involved. But I am better now. I know more languages now than I did before. And I do find I can pick things up with a rapidity that I never used to be able to. The problem is my time is also much more full. As a guy in his late 40s, I have far less time available than when I was in my teens. And so things are easier for me, and financially it's easier, and coming by tools is easier, but finding the time isn't. And so, well, perhaps I can learn things because of my history and my experience and all these extra helps I get. I can do things more rapidly, and yet the time window I have shrinks at a rate even faster than the rapidity of how quickly I can learn things. One funny thing came up recently. I was at a client's office who had a really old database system that just had some errors. The person had created it a few years ago, was no longer in the country, and I happened to be at their office. They said, could you just take a look at this? And like, it's a system we've never even heard of before. We don't know how to change it. We had a few people look at it, and nobody even understands what the heck it is. And it turns out it was in something called Live Code, which is basically like a modern version of HyperCard or SuperCard. It's card-based. It uses the same sort of, you know, you create a button. It's a visual rapid development tool, and you can deploy from that to Mac or PC or Linux or iPhone and iPad. And basically, it's like HyperCard. It's just a currently existing HyperCard that I didn't know existed. But I did HyperCard years ago. So I sat down on this, and I'm clicking through. I'm like, oh, yes, okay, I get it. Here's the object model, and there are going to be scripts. And inside this button will be the script. I just open up. It just looked like HyperTalk. I just, without even looking, I just was able to make all the changes they want. They had just switched over to a different database, and I found where those objects were, and just, okay, let's just make a quick change and deploy it. And they wanted a color change and move some buttons, so I did some graphic tool and saved and done, and just, you know, went to the menu, deployed it, and said, okay, it's now all working. So it is the case that when something is in your wheelhouse, even if it's brand new, I'd never even heard of Live Code before, it was like in a matter of minutes had picked it up and was able to deploy it for a customer. But that's just because it was built on top of something I had spent a ton of time enjoying in the past. So I got lucky. So if I don't get lucky, or it's not based on something I've already done, like say 6502 assembler, then I just twiddle my thumbs and don't seem to actually produce anything. So.
Yeah, I think you're right about the access to the materials too, and solved problems in YouTube videos and things. It does seem like the thought I was thinking about was like holding a PDF of the magazine, you know, and trying to figure out like what is it saying about like what happens here and what happens there, and that seems like that's still a conceptually difficult thing. But having that magazine in front of me was a harder thing in the past. And being able to read the magazines from Britain or Finland or, you know, someplace that I'm not, you know, is also, there's a whole set of things that many people found answers to things that, never got communicated to me before.
And I was lucky back in the day that I was a kid in Toronto for a lot of my youth. And so that was a big city where a lot of things were available to me. I was very lucky that it was available in my school system. It was available at local bookstores and local computer shops. And like a lot of local things were made available because I was fortunate financially and because I was fortunate geographically. And a lot of people back in the 80s might have been in a more rural location or something. They simply wouldn't have access. And while the internet might have existed, the modern internet and the web and YouTube and stuff wouldn't have. And so a lot of people probably today have access to tools they couldn't have dreamed of having access to 30 years ago.
Right, even if they were there.
Mm.
So, I mean, like the YouTube, of course, wasn't. But I mean, like even if there was something developed in England, you know, you wouldn't have it if you were.
You might not have even heard of it. Exactly. Yeah. And so a lot of you know, reinventing the wheel and stuff. Whereas again, those easy to find solutions to solve problems and that I can just build upon is a huge advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we are sad that we have not, or pathetic in some way that we have not actually created something.
But. I believe that is definitely the conclusion, that there are no excuses. And oh my goodness. Oh, well.
Anyway. Yeah. No, I thought it's interesting to think about, and it's definitely one of the things that I would like to do with the hobby is, you know, expand. I want to do more of the stuff that I liked doing in the past, but I do
want to expand.
That's
something that hasn't changed. The desire is still there. I still, all these years later, have a desire to create Apple II games, to learn new things on modern computers, to learn new things on old computers of the platforms I used to use, platforms I didn't use. It still appeals to me. Unlike a lot of hobbies, a lot of trends, a lot of fads that have come and gone in my life, this is still there. And I think it's probably the case with a lot of our listeners as well, because people that are into retro computers often were into them back in the day, and they are the early adopters. They're the people who like the new technology, and you're just sort of wired that way, that it really appealed to you back in the 80s. And for that same reason, both new old things and new things will still appeal to you, because that's just how we're wired. Other people in my family, computers didn't really knock their socks off in the 80s, and they kind of don't now. They use them and they're interesting, but they don't get that butterfly thrill that I would get from seeing something I think is going to change the world, or from suddenly grokking the way to do something on a computer, or the drive to solve a problem technologically. And those things still drive me and still interesting me. So, which is why I'm hoping eventually that drive and my available time come together and I have a game.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, good luck. Okay. Anyway, so maybe we can leave that there, but hopefully that will have given people things to think about and they can leave feedback, to which I will now turn. So let's see. So there were a couple of things that people posted on the Facebook group. So Stephen linked to a scan of a book that the book itself was posted on the Chicago Classic Computing site, but I'm not sure. It may be on archive.org and in other places as well. I don't think the Chicago Classic Computing site has a particular claim to it apart from possibly having made it available, but it's kind of an interesting book in that it is so it's called A Reader's Guide to Microcomputer Books. It's one of many things that are scanned there and available on the site. But what's kind of curious about this is that it is kind of a book that is reviewing other books. So you might remember that at this time, it was the beginning of a huge onrush of like microcomputers and BASIC and how to use your Apple II and how to use your TRS-80 and all these things. You know, so this is kind of like a meta review of like what are the pros and cons of all the books as of 1983. So this is Michael Nasita, perhaps, and Ronald Petrucha, who have written this book in 1983. And if you want to look at it, if you're sort of perusing physical books on eBay or other sites and wondering which one to get, this might and they were published by 1983, then this might be some help. It's kind of neat to see what was out there, too.
I think it's fantastic for a couple of reasons. One is I hadn't encountered something like this before, and I think it's really neat that it's like a Yahoo thing, like it's a list of just other things. And the reviews, or really the summaries of each of the books, is relatively small. It just gives you a sense of kind of what it is. But for me, I think it's important and really fascinating, because it let me know about a lot of books I probably would have never heard of before. So you wouldn't know to look for something because you didn't even know it existed. Like there, I wrote down some ideas of books that I want to now go seek out. Like there's one called Computer Capers about electronic thievery and embezzlement. I'm like, well, that sounds fascinating. And so there's a few books like that that I wouldn't have even thought to go seek out. And nicely, it gives the ISBN number for each of the books it talks about. And that is the key for finding these things on like ABE books or just online, because it's a nice specific number that links to a specific book and has not changed since the 80s. So really, really great for getting you interested in a book. And then because the ISBN giving you a way to find that book made me very happy. So I've written down three or four that I'm going to now seek out because of this thing. So it's awesome.
Yeah, no, I am looking forward to looking at it a little more closely, but as I was scanning through, there's a Computer Consciousness, Surviving the Automated 80s.
Excellent, excellent. And there were a bunch that I knew about, like the 10 Easy Pieces books, and like, so it was remind me of books I'd either read back in the day, or I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that, or I have that book now or something. But mostly I found it interesting because a ton of books I never heard of before.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks, Stephen, for pointing that out. I will definitely, it will, you know, all that free time that was being cleared out for COBOL now gonna go to this. Let's see, so also on Facebook, Douglas wrote, I will now quote, I've been toying with the idea of building a CRT board for my homebrew Z80 computer. I've got an idea to use either the MC6845 or the TMS9918, which would be accessed through an 8255 PIO. Probably the second for timing reasons. Has anyone here designed their own CRT controller card? End quote. So if this means something to you, Douglas may be looking for suggestions, warnings, you know, camaraderie or advice. I think
or
I sort
hospital
of,
visits when they implode. And right. <destroy him.
laughs> So, I mean, it sounds like an interesting project. I think I kind of know what all those chips are, more or less. But it was somewhat amusing string of text that very inside.
Well, I mean, I've heard of the 6845, the Motorola CRT controller, but I have no experience in this sort of thing at all. So, and would be very impressed if somebody actually made a video display controller. So,
Yeah. So hopefully it we'll get an update on the Facebook group as to, you know, how that progresses, if it progresses.
I was never a hardware guy though. So hardware always seemed like deep, scary magic to me. I'm a software person.
I thought that was true of me as well, but it turns out actually that there's a psychological barrier that if you get past it, it's actually all that stuff in the 80s is pretty simple.
Well, I'm sure that it is, and I remember somebody in the 80s used to always keep telling me, like, other than the physically putting things together and the soldering, hardware is software. But it still seems scary, and it still seems confusing to me. So.
Yeah, yeah. No, and actually, that's another area that, you know, from the host topic that I kind of wanted to get more into. I've been collecting all these things I need to solder together.
You've been collecting?
Well, dumping in a pile, maybe, but yeah. Okay, let's see. Pavel has been sharing a number of videos that have been selected from a site called RetroGameTV.com, which is basically like an... as far as I can tell, it's like an organized playlist of links to YouTube videos. I think maybe they're all YouTube videos that are mostly organized by platform. So there's Amiga and Amstrad CPC and Apple II and Arcade and Atari and other things that don't begin with A, all the way down to the ZX Spectrum. And they're basically just game playthroughs. You know, it's an organized way to find gameplay playthroughs, so you don't have to just go to YouTube and search, you know, Amiga game or whatever. So... they're pretty neat. I cannot say that I have watched them all, but it's a pretty big list, actually.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, it's a remarkably large list.
So, they're pretty cool. If you are on the Facebook group, you will have seen these going by. They seem to be appearing about once a day, but they're cool. So, this next one, so Chris wrote in to point out the story of an engineer who rigged a rotary phone to play a text adventure. And Carrington, I think you have already spoken of this.
We
elsewhere.
Did on Eaten by a Grew. We talked about this. This it was created by a fellow named Mitch, who is friends with Kevin, who I do the Eaten by a Grew podcast with. Right. And it's incredibly exciting. Like, it's the most amazing thing. So it's a phone that will... literally play a text adventure to you. So it reads the prompts back and you speak into the phone in response. So you'll say go north. It interprets your, like, it does speech to text to interpret what you've just done, executes the move, and then reads you the response. So it's a telephone into which you speak and can play a text adventure.
It's interesting.
It's bonkers. It's amazing.
Can't quite imagine making it all the way through, you know, Zork or whatever.
Yeah, but I can't really imagine making it through most text adventures anyway. So just like, even with typing, I apparently have learned from doing Eat and My Gru that I need a lot of cheats to get through these games. So I need another phone that will read me walkthroughs, and then I'll just hold the two receivers back to back against each other, and then I can just leave the room.
Yeah, nice. Anders wrote in to call attention to the retrogathering in, and Jack has pronounced this a couple of times. I think it's something like Westeros. It always sounded sort of like Westeros to me.
I hope that it does take place in Westeros. That sounds great and dangerous.
That's all I know about it. I haven't actually read or seen any of these things, but I'm kind of aware of the universe in which it resides. But this particular one is actually in Sweden, I think.
I can say you're aware of Sweden? Yes, that is the universe in which it resides.
Yep. So, and it's very soon. It is February 4th. So if you're listening to this, it's probably like today or tomorrow or something, depending on how quickly I get this out. But so it's very soon. So if you are interested, there is a link in the show notes to it. I think it is just the one day. So.
And it's not too far outside of Stockholm. Doesn't look like an impossible place to get to. So, because, you know, Sweden has some northern parts that would be more difficult to get to.
Yeah, it is kind of tall and long.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so if it's interesting to you and you're able to go, it's soon, go check that out. And I think the last feedback bit is Rob wrote in to point out a page, there's a Google Plus page and also a YouTube channel by somebody named Proxima038. I do not know actually who this is, but basically, so the Google Plus page is basically links to YouTube videos, but they are generally things like running a PDP-8M or a PDP-8E and getting a running a paper tape machine, an Anita MK8 calculator, an Intellect 8 8080 development computer. There's some stuff that is on the older side of retro computing that's being demonstrated here, and it's pretty cool. It's not a page I'd ever seen before. It showed up in our feedback, and so people should go look at that and, you know, hit the thumbs up button or whatever it is.
Yeah, and I think these are like, it's somebody running an actual PDP-8 too. This doesn't look like, it's not like the little, you know, the mini kit ones that have come out. Like, this is somebody with an actual PDP-8. Actually using it. Very cool.
Yeah, it is. And it's loud too.
Oh, tape readers. Yeah, like,
mm-hmm. Well, even the machine itself, like, I was thinking, if you wanted to do this, if you want to emulate the experience with a PyDP8, maybe you can, you know, turn on the PyDP8 and the vacuum cleaner. You know, but anyway, so that's it for the feedback. But here I had this idea that maybe if there were two of us, it would wind up being shorter, but so far that's not happening.
No, we're just going to keep recording until more people join us.
Right. But okay, so that'll do for the feedback. We can turn to the items of interest, and you have the first one.
I do, and the first one is not retro, kinda. See, here's the thing, is when you think about old computers, mostly you think about their guts. I think about, you know, computers that are relatively slow or don't have a lot of modern capabilities, or they run at 1 megahertz, or they only have 8K RAM or something like that. But another sort of defining factor to old computers is older looking cases. If you think about the Apple One, you might think of it as a computer maybe inside a wooden case, a handmade case, something like that. So another way to think of retro computers is from their industrial design, and other ways to go. And we kind of eventually standardized on the poured plastic and blah, 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 and everything's kind of boring and the same. Well, there's a new computer, completely modern on the inside, but kind of retro feel on the outside, coming soon, called the Volta. It's, I think, going to overheat like crazy But it is what it is. But it's made of wood. And I just really like the idea that this is a wooden computer. Now, I got more excited because I thought it was completely made of wood. Like, you'd open it up and it's just all carved or something. No, it's really just relatively modern, you know, i3 guts or something. Oh, in fact, Core i5 and i7, oh my goodness, is definitely going to heat like crazy. So it's a gaming computer, but it is locked inside a really pretty carved wooden case. And I think that's neat, and I wish more things existed like this. You can, for I think $400 US, you can reserve your right to buy it, and it's going to start at $2,000 and up. So not cheap. And again, I think it's going to overheat like crazy, but it's neat and different. And it really caught my eye because it had a retro feel to it. It's like if the old, Philips television became a modern computer. That's what you'd end up with here. So it's pretty looking and very mid-century modern, and you can get it in a couple of different wood choices. So the Volta, coming soon to an overheating desktop near you.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. I hadn't looked too closely at this before. You know, I'd seen it kind of going through the feeds and stuff, but I didn't have any idea what the size was like until I got a little lower. It's
big.
It's pretty big. It's, you know, like a keyboard and a half wide or something.
A wooden keyboard.
Yeah.
It doesn't come with a wooden keyboard, unfortunately.
Yeah, but you can hide your keyboard underneath it so you can't see the plastic.
In shame.
The plastic.
You can hide your shameful plastic keyboard. So it's cool. Yeah. So we'll have a link in the show notes to this expensive but pretty wooden computer.
Yeah. There's, what is it now? What was the wooden S100 computer? North Star Horizon. That was what I was looking for.
I was racking my brain. North Star. It was the North Star, yes.
And so, of course, all the North Star Horizons that exist now, their wooden casing hasn't fared very well over the years. But it's quite possible that you're not intending to use the Volta in 30 years from now.
I am.
Yeah. Well, pretty cool, though. Let's see. I guess I'm probably up next. What did I have?
Something that I'm not expected to understand.
Yes. So this is something that probably is familiar to many people, maybe even people who are listening to this. But this is the first time I had encountered this. It is basically a quote from the version 6 Unix source code. I can read it, actually. It says, "If the new process paused because it is swapped out, set the stack level to the last call to savu_s_sav. This means that the return, which is executed immediately after the call to aretu, actually returns from the last routine which it did the savu. You are not expected to understand this." Yeah. So it says this in the source code to Unix, and Unix 6th edition. And this was actually, the 6th edition was published in a pretty pretty widely circulated book called The Lion's Commentary. So it contained all the source code and then some comments on it. And it's sort of known to be one of the most photocopied books, you know, in computer science. And apparently it's actually pretty good. So this is still a bit before my time. But it does contain this little thing. This, you're not expected to understand this. and apparently this was a meme back in the olden days when, you know, before there was the internet, really. And so this is a very famous line. And Dennis Ritchie, I guess, later explained this as the intent was that, like, this isn't on the test. Like, I know this is complicated. You can get by without understanding this, but somehow it was kind of taken to be like a challenge.
Right.
So
I love it.
It's pretty cool. So fairly recently there was a posted on the new stack, kind of like a discussion of this, which I think actually came from a talk at, the Systems We Love conference contained a talk about this. Systems researcher Arun Thomas explained to the audience what it was that they weren't supposed to understand. So digging deep into this one little context switching, it was basically had to do with like processes switching control between each other and like how it saved the context and what happened in a certain kind of situation. But so he kind of went through that. And I'm not sure that the talk is actually online. It might be, but it doesn't seem to be linked in here. But just the story of this comment was kind of interesting. So there's a couple of links I'll have in the show notes to, you know, things that the Lion's Commentary and the discussion of this code. I thought it was just interesting because it's old stuff that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Unix heads out there will probably be well aware of this, but there are shirts and things, you know, that say you're not expected to understand this. So I will leave it there unless you had any,
no,
any
but I'm just
memory
enjoying
of this.
It. Nope.
Yeah,
nope.
It's pretty cool.
But it's awesome.
Okay, so you can tell us about what Dagan's been up to.
Oh, Dagan, he's so awesome. So there's a great video out, the making of Apple Zini, so an 8-bit game programming special. So we will have the link to Dagan's video. So that's something to watch, but it's more about the content of this video and why it's exciting and hopefully might encourage people like me to get off our butts and actually do something. So
yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very much in keeping with this our initial topic. So in the video, what Dagan does is the end-to-end production of an 8-bit game in AppleSoft Basic, but using some more recent tools, in particular Buckshot. So we spoke about Buckshot either last episode before, something like that. So it's the Apple II image converter tool. So it's a cross-platform tool that will let you take a modern image and it will output an 8-bit Apple II image. And you can then use that on, like, in game development or in production on your Apple II software. And so this is great because not only does it show the end-to-end production, it shows using tools like this. And so that's what's exciting about it. So in it, he makes the Apple Zini game, which is a relatively straightforward and spelling word. The game itself isn't necessarily going to light the world on fire, but the use of Buckshot and seeing that actually get used, that's really exciting. So great video. I actually only skimmed through it right before we were recording. So I'm going to now have to go back and watch the whole thing. It's about 50 minutes. And so I've taken in like 3 minutes versions of it as I skim through. But even that has me quite excited to watch this and kind of see Buckshot in action is the thing I'm most excited about it. But way to go, Dagan. That's what I say.
Yeah, I'm pleased to have that because it really does kind of show, it makes it not seem very scary. It's nice to see just someone doing it. You know, you don't have to try to figure out like how do I get from this step to this step. You can just see like, all right, well, if someone who knows what they're doing wants to do that, this is what they do.
Exactly. And Dagan's videos are great. Like, I would recommend also just subscribing to his channel because I subscribe and he doesn't have like a ton of videos up, but his Apple II stuff are really, really clearly explains the content. Like, he'll do a 6-minute dive into something and you'll just come out of it totally getting what he's talking about. So
the problem with videos, of course, is that you have to use your eyeballs. So I can't use that as easily when I'm, you know, sort of like walking around and cleaning the house and stuff, whereas I can listen to audio podcasts. So I tend to fall behind on the video ones.
That's why podcasts are the best.
That's right. That's right. We win. actually, one other thing I was going to say, too, about Buckshot is just to complete the circle of credit there. Buckshot is sort of like a GUI front end on a command line program called BMP to DHR. Yeah.
Right. And who is that by?
And that is by Bill Buckles. So,
okay.
So a lot of the hard actual sort of like bit crunching that gets done is actually being done by that. So, I mean, not to diminish the accomplishment that Dagan has achieved, but it is also relying on something that is in its own right an accomplishment.
Yeah, so, very, very, very much so. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because that kind of thing is important because a lot of the modern tools are relying on other things behind the scenes, like the command line actual programs getting things done. It is the case, though, to give Dagan his, like, I hadn't known about that tool ahead of time, and it was the existence of Buckshot and its relatively easy to use graphical front end opened this up to the world to me, like made me aware of it, made it more usable. Like, so that kind of thing, even if it is built upon something that already existed, often just makes it accessible enough that suddenly it's going to be a tool I actually use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true, true. I had never used it before, but I have used Buckshot. So, yeah, we'll see. I'm hoping that this will inspire people to make things. I know I will. I'm definitely going to play around with it a bit. But So he uses Buckshot, and he also uses a music sequencer, the name of which I have now forgotten. But oh yeah, K-Synth. I think it's like a synth editor. But that's actually based on something that Charles Mangan, I think maybe did/extracted out of Karateka.
Right.
So,
And the other tool he uses, I just should mention because I keep hearing about it, but I have yet to use it, is GS Plus, which is the 2GS emulator. It's a cross-platform Apple 2GS emulator, and I have yet to use it, but it just seems to keep coming up. So eventually I'm going to have to check this thing out.
And I think that's Dagan's also, isn't it? I think he wrote it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, well, there you go. Way to go, Dagan. See, Dagan's rocking.
Yeah. I see. It's based on Kegs, but it's the GS Plus version of it is Dagan's. So, yeah, we all work on it. We're all sort of like building on other people's stuff, but mm-hmm. But
and we're all in the shadow of Dagan.
Yeah. Cool. Let's see. My next thing is this came in over feedback, but it merited a point of interest in news. Tezza, Terry Stewart, has on his blog put together a downloadable software library for real or virtual Exidy sorcerers. So as I understand it, he fairly recently either got or got out his Exidy sorcerer and was kind of sort of compiled together a bunch of software that exists for it that you could use for it. And he has a page, and it's actually quite a lot. It looks to me like it is all in the form of audio that you can play into your sorcerer. So, and I don't actually know very much about these. They're S100 machines, but they have kind of like it's a old style, you know, keyboard into box kind of style. It's like mm-hmm. all one piece. So it doesn't look like an S100 machine to me.
But I don't think so either. Whenever I see one of these, I never would think S100. Mostly because I don't think of S100 things having keyboards.
Right. Or being small.
or being small. Exactly. Neither of those scream S100 to me.
I don't think they're very easy to get. You know, like if you see them on eBay, they go by very, very expensively. But if you do happen to have one or want to play around in an emulator, this is a great collection of stuff. I mean, like, this will take you weeks to go through, probably. So thank you for that, for putting that up and for letting us know about that. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. there's a link to a JSorcerer emulator that will, I think, be JavaScript. I'm not sure.
I would probably assume. But talk about also other videos worth watching. Tezza is another person mm-hmm. that people should definitely subscribe to on YouTube because his videos are amazing.
Yeah. And as is his collection.
Yeah. Oh, the collection is just mind blowing.
Yeah.
It's just bonkers. And also I love that he re-released a ton of his videos in high quality and just, it's fantastic. I mean, just even just from an archaeological standpoint, like he's got videos that show such detail on so many things. It's mm-hmm. just mind blowing. He has a full museum unto himself. It's incredible.
Yeah. Excellent. Yes, I at some point would like to try to simulate or emulate or do what he's doing, but he's done a great job with mm-hmm. with just sort of explaining what all the computers are. He's cleared up enough space to actually, you know, set them up and take videos of them.
But also has such great knowledge that mm-hmm. like he's really good at also exercising all the stuff and bringing out, say, okay, like what's in what condition and what do I got to change and like, so keep everything alive and just amazing. Like it's just nice to see such a huge and valuable collection, but clearly in the right person's hands. Like if it was in my hands, it would just be such a waste. Everything would be destroyed.
Sat on another one.
That's it. Exactly. So it's just like, I should not be allowed to have nice things. Right. Whereas Tezza is just, he's doing it right.
Okay, I think I'll leave the news there, and now, a word from our sponsor.
January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
And we're back. So I am the host, I guess, and I have been tasked with picking the gift idea. And the sort of a thematically relevant, I think, one is the Civilization the Board Game. So Sid Meier's Civilization the Board Game, you can You can get it on Amazon. I'm not sure where else you can get it. Well, I'll link to the Amazon page. It is $70 with free shipping, and they have only two left in stock, but perhaps they will have more. So this is the, I mean, as basically you would guess, it is the board game version of Civilization. You have a map and many, many little pieces of things you can put down on the map. And presumably, I actually don't know much more about the game. I assume there's some sort of element of chance and dice and things like that. Do you know anything about this, Carrington?
I do not. Nope. Alas. Although I am a fan of any sort of board game based on any video game. I just love the concept of that, regardless of how poor the implementation it is.
Yeah, so if you want to spend your time rebuilding civilization, this is a, you know, it's a
which we might want to practice. Yes, it might be a good time to start practicing such things.
Right. And there was a thematically related thing that I came across. It was actually posted in 2012, but it was posted on Reddit somewhere. I've been playing the same game of Civilization 2 for almost 10 years. This is the result. And the poster sort of goes through and describes that essentially it kind of got locked into a steady state where the world is a hellish nightmare of suffering and devastation. There are three remaining supernations in the year 3991 AD, each competing for the scant resources left on the planet after dozens of nuclear wars have rendered vast swaths of the world uninhabitable wastelands.
This is like the best game write-up I have read in forever, because it's basically been 2,000 years of almost constant war. And when he talks about how there's three governments left, there's two theocracies and his own, which is a communist state, and he wanted it to be a democracy. But the Senate kept overruling him, so he had to like do away with democracy about 1,000 years ago because it was endangering his empire. And now these three countries are just 2,000 years of constant war. So funny.
Yeah. So it actually got a write-up in the Atlantic Monthly, and there's a little bit of a discussion of how the internet is trying to help him, you know, because the whole sort of premise of this is that the player who has been running this for so long would like to try to see if he can get it out of this state, and wants to save the world in some way, and so had it, you know, 4 years ago turned to Reddit to try to figure out how. You know, my goal for the next few years is to try to end the war and thus use engineers to clear swamps and fallout and so that farming may resume.
And I like how Reddit, which is, of course, just an awful cesspool of terribleness in general, is what Reddit is. But there is now a subreddit called The Eternal War, which is dedicated just to how can they bring about the end of war in this particular game of Civilization 2. I love it. I absolutely love it.
So, and I don't actually know how it turned out, who knows? Maybe the war is still going on.
The write-up is hilarious.
They've had
though.
4 years.
I mean, just... Even if you've never, like, I've never played Civilization. The game never appealed to me. But this write-up about the current state of his game after 2,000 years of constant war is hilarious.
Yeah. Oh, well. So, a little bit of levity for your, to bring up your spirits just a bit.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, that's the retro computing gift idea. And we can now turn to eBay auctions. And there are two of us, and yet many, many, many auctions picked. So
I only picked two things. I knew I was going up against you. And I'm like, well, I might as well have more than one then. I picked two things, both of which I think I picked versions of before. One I picked because of the price, and one I picked because of the model. So the first I'm picking, both of them are Apple things, just because I wear my prejudice on my sleeve. So there's an Apple IIc, a pretty nice-looking one, terrible photographs, so it's all fuzzy, and so it's really hard to tell in this kind of photograph with its massive amount of JPEG how, like, the condition of the case, like how white things really are. When they hide the handle on a 2C, you can't really tell how white a 2C is because the white balance on your photograph can be all over the place. But you can normally judge by the difference between the handle and the case. Like, that's the key when you're buying an Apple IIc. Anyway, there's one of these. It's $200, which is quite pricey for just a 2C. But if it's in really nice condition and it claims to look like like new, then it's a pretty decent price because it's the A2S 4100 model, which I think is the sweet spot, perfect model for the 2C. Most people will argue that the 2C Plus is the better one, but I think the 5.25-inch floppy drive is so much more useful on an 8-bit Apple II, so I prefer to have the 5.25-inch built in, but the early Apple IIcs have a really terrible keyboard, whereas this is the very late model of the 2C. So it's the regular 2C, but with the really nice keyboard and can take the memory expansion, so it's got like the last version of the ROM and such. And also has the built-in 5.25-inch drive, and yet you can also do an external drive as well. So I think it's like the sweet spot model for the 2C is the 4100. And sometimes it's hard to tell which model it is if it doesn't call it out in the eBay listing. But this is one of those. $200 is kind of at the high end of what I would pay. But if it is in like new condition, then that's I think a fair price. The other one I'm selecting is the early model of the Apple Studio Display, the 15-inch. It's the M4551. There's a few of these, the flat panel LCD monitor from Apple, that were all the M4551. Some are the blueberry color like this, and some are the darker gray color that came later. The real difference between them a lot of times is the connector, whether it's the VGA connector or the later ADC connector and such. But what I like about the blueberry model, I don't like the color as much as I like the later ones, but the blueberry ones come with the VGA input. So if you're looking to use a pretty high quality, decently bright, decently fast LCD monitor that's a 4x3 display and has in it a really good video input, if you just want the yellow connector to take from an old vintage computer into an LCD, I have thrown tons of different old signals, 15 hertz signals or whatever, at that connector in that particular Studio Display model, and everything always seems to display perfectly because it was right at that cusp of moving to modern LCDs but still having to support basically the Apple II era. And so I guess it just got tested with tons of things or who knows what, but I find it's something you can throw anything at. $99, the downside to this listing is it doesn't show it working. They say they don't have the right power cord. It's just a typical 3-prong power cord, so it worries me. But with this model, a lot of people don't, they look at them and it's got like a weird connector and they don't really know what to do about it. But if it is working, and I think probably it is, then $99 is actually a pretty good price for it. So those are my two choices.
Cool. Yeah, I have one that I guess is the more recent model. I was just, it happens to be on my desk, so I was just looking at it. And, and it definitely has some different, I don't have the one that has the nice composite.
Yeah, you'll have if you've got a USB connector, for instance, then it's the later sort of models. And well, that can be handy. For me, like the real joy of these is to use them on an older computer. If I'm just going to use like a VGA connector or something, there's a lot of other LCD monitors you can use that frankly are better panels. But this has the advantage of something that you could lug to Kansas Fest, for instance, and say, I can plug an Apple II into this and it's going to look nice and give me a 640x480 display with a decent upscaling to it. Like everything seems to look nice and clear on it when you plug in old NTSC signals.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Oh, and also has I forgot to mention it, but it has an S video connector as well. So it's a nice like use it on an old computer and also have like a game system beside it or something. So pretty versatile monitor for $99 and a neat retro monitor. So it won't look completely out of place if you have it sitting on an old computer.
Cool. Yeah. It's S video is the same as something. I think it's is it an ADB cable? There's something that's a. There's one of those Mac cables. It's either like a serial cable or an ADB cable that is actually identical to an S-video cable.
I think, it looks, because it's some sort of DB9 thing or something, so it looks kind of like ADB, but I don't know if it's exactly identical, like it would fit in. It looks like
it, though. I think it is, because I think I've got an S-video cables to run my keyboards.
There you go.
So, I got a black S-video cable for my Mac TV, because I didn't have an appropriate cable for it, and it looked kind of stupid having a gray cable coming out of the black machine. But I like how on the 2C, everything looks really nice. You probably know where I'm going with this. Everything's all like nice and white and bright, except there's this ring around the power brick.
Yep.
Because they all do that, and I think it's heat. I think it just gets hot in that spot. But But I have a couple of these bricks, and they all look just like that.
They had that exact. I think it's heat as well. It never really bothers me if it's a crappy looking power brick, like that big honking power brick that comes with the 2C. Partly because there's modern versions you can get instead that you can just use, which is what I use. Or it's the kind of thing that you tuck away. You wouldn't actually be looking at it. I'm much more concerned with the coloring of the 2C case itself.
Right, right. That's the thing people will see.
Yeah. And in this, it's hard to tell because that fuzzy photograph, but I think it's nice. But I don't know if I'd actually drop my own $200 on it, but it's, you know, you got to come up with something.
Yep. Okay, so I will...
So what do you got?
Run through a couple things here. So the first one is... This is... So what does it say? It says ATR 8000. It's a Z80 computer, IBM 8088 coprocessor for an Atari. So it's not a very interesting looking box, but I think it's kind of interesting inside, you know, that it's basically, I think it's like a CPM computer, and I think I knew it. Yeah, DOS plus CPM on an Atari 400, 800, 800 XL. So, which basically means, you know, it's a PC type computer that you use your Atari as a keyboard for. So I think they're super rare. So that would explain the $750 buy it now price. But one of the things that kind of even caught my attention more was the fact that it has a 5 1/4 inch floppy drive that goes with it. And for some reason, I do not entirely understand, they mounted it inside an NES case.
Yep.
So it's in this Nintendo, it's like obscured, it's hidden away inside this Nintendo box, which is, you know, I think has no Nintendo left in it. It was just sort of cut open and a floppy drive was put in.
And I don't understand why. At all. Like, and it's not that, like, it does fit. I guess somebody noticed that the left to right dimensions are the same for the floppy drive mechanism as they are for the little flip up lid in front of an NES, but you still have to carve away places for the buttons. Like, I don't understand why somebody mutilated this NES for this, but okay.
Yeah, it's not the right era. There's nothing sensible about it, except it was probably a nearby plastic box.
Oh, it's very weird, but yep.
Yeah. Kind of sad in a way.
Totally.
So if you're interested in the ATR 8000, that is quite possibly of interest. Now, yesterday I put in, I'll put the auction in anyway. Yesterday I put in an auction for an Apple network server, 700, 200, and it was actually fairly close to me. It was buy it now of $2,000. I probably could have gone out and gotten it. It said free shipping though, so I probably would have lost out if I had done that.
Is that a good price for them though? $2,000? Like, I have no idea what these go for.
Well, apparently they go for $2,000 because this was I put it in here less than 24 hours ago and it's gone now. These are quite rare things. They are one of the only sort of later Apple devices that's not a Mac, but it's kind of in the Mac world. It is specifically a network server. It's a big box. They are pretty big, and I think they are pretty heavy.
It would run AIX, right?
Yeah. You open it up and it looks like Mac stuff inside. I mean, it's an Apple device, but they just didn't sell, I don't think, very many of these. And those that they did sell were expensive, you know.
Looking at the industrial design, and especially the bottom of the case, the part that it's kind of sitting on, it screams Duo. Like, it looks like a Duo dock. You can slide a computer. Like, so you can just peg the era this comes from. So the industrial designer that worked on this clearly was also working on the Duo dock.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't noticed about that, but you're right. The base looks like it's gray, like a Duodoc is, and the rest of it looks like two, you know, kind of like two Quadra stuck together.
It totally does. It's got that particular era of frog design or whatever. Like, you can tell the Apple's design phases, and this is clearly bang in the middle of the Duo phase.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's an interestingly rare item to see, but you can't buy it because someone already did, and it wasn't me.
It's funny too, for me personally, getting one of these wouldn't massively appeal, like running IAX, but the Quadra 700, which looks nothing like this, but all, does have 700 in its name, is a computer that greatly appeals to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I too am not sure that I, like, it would be kind of neat to have one because I know that, you know, they're, aren't many of them. Hmm. But that's not a very good reason, ultimately.
to spend $2,000.
Certainly not, yeah. I mean, if one appeared, I might be, you know, it might be kind of fun to actually use it to serve a network, but... okay, the next one I have is actually a pretty nice Epson QX10 system. So every once in a while, one will come up and I will mention this. But the QX10 is the thing that many years ago, Earl and I both bid on, and I won out from under him. And I've felt bad about that for years ever since.
Bad.
But, and of course, by now I have, I don't know what, like three or four of them. But
anyway. All of which Earl had unsuccessfully bid upon.
Yeah.
Well, you feel bad. You also find it hilarious.
But what's cool about this one is that it actually, so it's got a printer, you know, an Epson printer.
An Epson FX80 for those playing at home. I was looking at it going, I know that printer. What is that printer? It's an FX80.
Yeah, it's if I didn't have one of those, I had an RX80 or an MX80. I'm not sure I know the difference between them, but it looks like an Epson printer. It's very
pleasant. Had an LX80.
Uh-huh. Is that wide carriage?
Nope. And it was kind of like it's hard to tell the difference between them. And in my mind, I was like, I think I had an LX80. And so I just Googled LX80 and the image that came up was the one that I had. And it was kind of pointier in the front, but a typical standard, like, I suspect the guts were the exact same small industrial change, that it was pointier in the front. And that's it. But that my Epson I had in that era was an LX80. I liked it. Good printer.
Yeah. And I do have nostalgia for these printers, but at the same time, they feel so useless.
Well, they kind of are. I have nostalgia for impact printers in general, and I do think that the world lost out a bit on them. And I get that they're slow and they're noisy and whatever, but they still can do some things that I really liked. And I like the permanence of just, you know, banging some form of ink onto paper. I like it. Although, when I was younger, what I always had were dot matrix printers. First, like the LX80 and stuff, and some ink printers before that, and then wide carriage ones, or the more pin, 24 pins and such. But what calls to me today, though, are the daisy wheel printers, although I never had one, and they're even slower and such. But I kind of wish, if I could have a printer today that would just work with a modern computer, I think I would like to have a daisy wheel, to be honest, versus like a laser printer. It'd be much more fun to have a daisy wheel clacking away.
It does seem like you could conceivably, you know, take a vintage computer of some kind and use it as a
print server. I think that's
exactly
the way to go. Yeah.
Essentially, yeah.
Because I've thought quite often about getting, because I recently got working a messenger printer or messenger typewriter with my Apple II using the little messenger module. So I have a typewriter that I can print to from my Apple II, and I'll probably bring it to Ken's Fest here. And that's super fun. But it's not quite what I want, which is to be on my modern Mac in a word processor and hit print and have a daisy wheel printer printed out, or have a daisy wheel printer clack away tweets or whatever when somebody tweets, like, and hear that in the other room, kind of like a stock ticker sort of feel. That would be fun and would add value to my life, I believe. And so I've been thinking along the lines of, I'm going to have to use a vintage computer as a print server to get that working, but that might be the next goal, I think.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
cool.
Anyway,
that's the rabbit hole that just the Epson LX80 image just sent me down.
Yeah, no, and as far as the whole system, so it's actually a little bit expensive. I think it's $575, buy it now, or you can make an offer. And to me, it would be $135 shipping, so it's non-trivial asking price here. Mm. However, it has the keyboard, which is specific to this computer. It has the computer. They show something on the screen. It has the monitor, and the monitor also is specific to this computer, so you can't just plug any monitor into it. It is powered by the machine, and it's specific to this.
It is nice in that it is the complete Epson set, like the Epson computer, the Epson monitor, the Epson keyboard, the Epson printer. My only concern is the monitor seems pretty dim.
Yeah, it's true. They show a picture of it, and it's not super bright.
That could be just an adjustment. Like, you never know, right?
Well, let's see. Let me take a look.
Ooh, it's got boxes. It even has boxes for everything. So it's a pretty nice setup. I don't know if I dropped $600 on it, plus God knows what shipping. But pretty cool.
Yeah, so the that actually was the thing that tipped it over the edge for me, is that the boxes, not only are there boxes, but there's the, like, the little disc inserts, the actual styrofoam in the box that holds the machine together. I think I have all of those boxes, but they are, like, in much, much worse shape. These are, like, nice and clean.
I like the idea, though, of in a few days when this episode comes out, Earl finding out about this auction from this episode, but you've already bought it.
Right.
That appeals to me greatly. I may chip in. You're that, Earl. That's what you get for not showing up.
By the way, I do. My actual desk setup is relatively insane. I have a desk that's, it's like a U shape, you know. So, like, I come in on one side.
Shape like me?
Well, like a square letter U. Right?
I am a square U.
Yeah. And so on sort of in the bottom portion of that, I have a regular, like, you know, big, however many inch iMac this is, you know, like a modern machine. And then sort of flanking it, I've got a tower of Apple things. I've got a PowerMac G3 and a LC475, a Duodoc, a CI, a 2GS, all sort of stacked in a vertical row.
Okay. Although, kudos on the 475. Still one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. And it has a 2E card in it, but nice. But given it wasn't working last time I tried, so I wanted to kind of, like, reseat it, except it's... Given its placement, if you remember, in that tower, there's a bit of a kind of like a psychological barrier to accessing it, because I have to move everything that's above it.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, so and then to my left, I have a 2E and an Apple III and a pet sitting on a K Pro, but behind my computer, facing the other way, I have a QX10 set up, so I'm actually looking right at the back of that monitor, and it does have a brightness knob. That was all I was going to say.
So there you go.
So it's quite possible that it could be brightened. And that monitor actually has two levels of brightness, too. So it might be just that those are the dim
right.
letters. But yeah, it's a nice setup. It is, if money is no object, this would be a good one to get.
That'd be a good lifestyle to have.
Yeah.
I don't right. currently have that lifestyle.
I think there are some people that do, though, and maybe not listening to this necessarily, but that bid against you.
Well, and the reality is that when it comes to purchasing things I wanted when I was young, I am essentially a multi-billionaire now. Like, things that would have been right. completely out of my price range as a kid, there's no chance I could have had them, are now relatively modest buy it nows on eBay. Like, it's, and so you do have to resist, or you'll end up with a house full of a million things. For me, it's more about the space, and in my life, I don't want it to be just full of a thousand things. I want just a couple things that I like.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I look at these auctions and I think, oh boy, you know, is that really worth $40 to me? That seems like a $25 thing. And, you know, like, when you sort of step back and say that, like, think about the things that you buy in your ordinary life, mm-hmm. that difference is very small, but yep. it still feels like there's a principle that you need to stand on somehow.
And I'm just much more of a minimalist too. Like, I want to just have very little physical things in my life. I love old computers and I love old industrial design. So they call to me. There's a siren call all the time, always, that I'm fighting against. So things like going to Kansas Fest and getting an annual hit to be able to be around all the computers and touch them and enjoy their industrial design, I think stops me from just becoming a massive hoarder.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Although it didn't stop me, but yeah, I can see what you. I can see if you know you're not giving up on it, you will have a chance to play with these things.
Right.
Then. Yeah.
So I'm really happy other people collect them, and then I get the occasional access to them, and then that's sort of enough to get me by.
Right. Right.
So what else have you selected on your list eBay auctions?
Just keep going here. Hopefully I won't have as much to say about each of these, but there's a North Star Horizon, which we talked about not too long ago. And this is what made me say about the, what was it called, the Volta, that not all wooden cases survive nicely. So the North Star Horizon is a S100 machine. It's just, you know, it's a box, but it's at least three sides, maybe more, but maybe just three, are wooden.
Mm.
So it has a very distinctive kind of furniture look to it.
But I think the North Star, looking at the way they fall apart now that I get... Because my memory always was, yeah, every time you see one of these, they look all kind of grungy. And I think it's because it was plywood with a veneer on it. And so that's all come apart. As you get any water in there, it swells, the glue, the veneer comes off. And I'm pretty sure that that new computer we talked about for thousands of dollars is actually going to be out of solid wood. Like it's actually out of some form of lumber. So that might help it survive a longer time. I want a computer carved from a solid old growth tree. No, I'm kidding.
Right. That's right. It's a, that's what, you know, it, you're sort of like, you're cutting away all the parts of the wood that aren't the computer. Isn't that how
exactly
that works?
I look at that giant elm and I see the Apple One inside it.
Anyway, but yeah, I've always kind of liked the look of the North Star Horizon.
Oh, me too.
But,
yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that.
How many of those do you have?
I have none. I'm happy to report that I do not have any. But and this one I will not get because it is reserve not met at a starting bid of $2,000.
Oh, but there was a buy it now on that though, wasn't there? Yeah, for $5,000.
$5,000. Yeah. So the next one, is it still here? It is. There is an Osborne Vixen. This is the OCC4. It is the last iteration of the Osborne pluggable computers, and I'm not sure if I have ever had one in my eBay auctions before. They come up super rarely. I mean, I think this might be the third one I've seen on eBay at most.
I don't think I've ever seen one. Not a Vixen.
It's one of those things I would really like to get, but I mean, this starting bid is $600 on this, and it's not in super shape. Actually, it's in okay shape. But it's like, you know, it's... Oh, and actually, they have a screenshot of it, which really doesn't look that great to me. They don't mention anything in the auction description about, you know, how the screen looks weird. But the screen looks weird.
But I don't know if that's because of the photograph, or if that's how this screen really is.
Yeah.
Because it kind of looks like it was shot halfway through a refresh of the scan line.
Yeah, it does.
Maybe. I don't see the appeal of these things anyway. I've never understood why people like Osborne's and their tiny little screens, 2,000 pounds of computer weight with a 4-inch screen or whatever. I don't get it. I do not get it at all why everyone else loves these things.
This one, though, has a... I mean, that looks like it might even be a 9-inch screen. That's a gigantic screen for an Osborne.
This must be a gigantic computer, though. If that's got the screen of it, like the size of an original old Mac... I don't know. I don't get the appeal. Neat looking keyboard, though.
Yeah, well, the design of it is, you know, it's sort of sleeker than the old. Like, there's a development in the design between the one, the. I don't know if there was a 3. The OCC2 is the executive. I don't know what the 03 would be, but the Vixen is the 04.
I just look at this and I imagine how heavy it is.
Yeah.
It just looks like it weighs 50 kilos.
Okay, well, I like it more than you do, apparently. So this particular one has got a couple of, like, the handles split apart a little bit, and there's a couple of the scuffs on it and stuff. So it's not great, but there are not many out there. So if you were interested, or if you just wanted to see one, I mean, these were featured in magazines and stuff at the time, but basically Osborne had collapsed at the point when this was. Of any use. So they did not sell any. This is the serial number 1858. So this is within the first 2000 they made.
And I looked it up and it actually only weighs about 18 pounds. I thought it would be more than that.
Okay. So what is that? I don't even know what that compares to, but that isn't too bad. It's probably way less than the original Osborne one, but it's pretty small. I mean, like it's got two vertical 5.25-inch drives, and that's basically the height of the main unit. So.
And you would be a serious hipster if you just sat in like a coffee shop and pulled out your Vixen.
Yeah.
Working on the novel.
It might even be cooler than the Commodore SX64.
Maybe.
For that purpose, but. Okay, so let me move on to, this is just a, I don't even know what this is. I mean, I sort of looked it up.
But you're going to buy it anyway.
This is the Columbia Commander M64 shoebox computer, and it just looks like a box.
It looks like a power supply is what it looks like. It doesn't look like a computer. It looks like something that's supposed to power a computer.
Yeah. But it is, you know, so it is a shoebox for a boot or something, I guess. Its front panel is a 5 1/4 inch drive plus a little bit on top kind of size. But apparently, it was expensive enough that it made me look into its history a little bit. So this is a starting bid of $579. So another one that I can't believe is worth that, really, but who knows? I'm sure it is uncommon. But there's a page that I found at xml.com dedicated to the Columbia Data Products Commander M64, also known as the Conky 64, also known as the Shoebox Computer, and has some photos of this. It's basically a Z80 based single board CPM computer in the same case as a disk drive. It has a couple of things, a place you can plug in a terminal and a modem in the back. And I think this would be kind of interesting to play around with. I think this would be kind of interesting to, you know, find in someone's basement, not buy for $600, but.
And it's funny too, it would be very easy to find this and assume you've just found a floppy disk drive, a computer. No. Like, now that as soon as you said that, I'm like, yeah, it is. It is basically, it's a floppy drive. But you've shrunk the whole computer down to be just the floppy drive.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's something I hadn't come across. It's 1984, I guess, you know, so it's in that area of prime retro.
Prime retro.
See previous episode.
See all previous episodes.
Yeah. Anyway, I think I'll leave. That'll do. I've rambled on enough with the eBay. And most of these today, I think, weren't ones that I was suggesting buying so much as suggesting looking at, but that's right.
Oh, and if you want to look at them, that's why we have show notes. So you can head over to rcrpodcast.com and see the show notes, and you can look at pictures of all the things that we are saying you should not buy.
Right. Except for that one that you should buy instead of Earl.
Well, that. Everyone should buy that one and send pictures to Earl.
Okay, so I guess we are now at the closing discussions point. Do you have any closing thoughts?
I got nothing. Buy less stuff, and please make your country be less insane, Paul. I would appreciate that. I want to come to Kansas Fest, and I'm honestly at the point where I'm a little worried about entering your country. So that's a new experience.
Yeah, it's takes some getting used to. I'm hoping that that getting used to is not what has to happen, but we'll see. We'll see. Maybe we'll see you next time, and maybe not.
It is bizarre that occurred to me today that probably it would be in my best interest to set up some fake social media accounts that I would have on my phone for when I cross the border. Now they're checking them, and if they looked at my actual social media accounts, I probably wouldn't be let in your country. So I probably am going to want to have a history of those, so I may have to produce a whole bunch of photos. And how terrible is that? Anyway, I'm having issues. I'm just having some serious issues. I'm trying to keep my mind off of and talking retro computers.
Yeah, exactly. We can sort of hide in the 80s. Though, I mean, you know, it's not like there was stuff like this before, but the you know, prime retro 80s weren't so great either.
No.
But, come to think of it.
Yep. Also depends on the country and things. And oh, absolutely. Yep. Just like, I'm old enough now, things should be better. Come on, world, get your crap together.
Yeah. Let's see. So my closing discussion had nothing to do with that. But I was just a little note that I was the auto-cracking program called Passport, which was designed by 4AM. And, you know, so basically the idea of this is that there's too many protected disks out there still left to deprotect. We don't have time to crack them by hand. And so 4AM made this program that would automatically sort of apply cracks that it could identify. And the program's called Passport, and it's now on GitHub, so that's the new development, is that there's a GitHub place for it. And so it's been kind of interesting, you know, watching the updates as people are adding in support for, you know, Activision titles and, you know, specific versions of Sierra games and things like that. So if you're sort of interested in the making of that particular sausage, it's pretty cool. So There'll be a link to that.
And it's funny too, because for the longest time, I was convinced and did my best to convince others that DRM did not work, does not work, cannot work. You cannot hand somebody a locked box and the key to the box and think it will stop them. But 4AM and Passport have convinced me otherwise, that DRM does work and did work for decades. And it's remarkable how much stuff was never deprotected. And I was like, oh, I was wrong about this completely.
Yeah, and we were actually quite lucky that that the protection, you know, software did often get outsourced. So, yep. You know, the big arcade and adventure games and stuff hired the same people that some of the educational stuff did, so that once you've learned how to crack the big adventure games that everybody cared about, you can actually also apply that to the things that nobody cared about but still didn't get preserved.
Right, you know, and so. It's remarkable, and that was one of the things that I never understood, was I was just assuming, since my life as a child was just full of games I want to play that had been cracked by other people, everything seemed to have been cracked. And that's just because the really popular stuff was. But there was so much software out there that nobody had the time or effort to go and crack. And so much is still unpreserved. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Yeah.
So
I've done a complete 180 on my thinking about that. And that's something that has happened over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I agree totally that I came into this years ago thinking that, you know, that Asimov had everything, you know, that everything had been preserved.
Totally.
And it's so not true.
I'm so wrong. I was so wrong. Yep. Oh, well.
Anyway, okay, so that's probably, we've managed to do as long a show probably as as ever.
So that may mean that the reason the shows are this long is you and me.
It's possible, yeah.
I mean, we are the contributing factors.
Yeah, or there's some sort of like, you know, physics conservation law or something that just says, you know, if you have only two people, they will speak for longer each.
The law of RCR. All shows will be an hour and a half no matter what we try.
Right. However, I think I will finish this one off and say that that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all of the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can join our Facebook group and get mentioned in our feedback section by going to facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. It's getting somewhat lively there, so join the community. You can send email feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. Please write a review on iTunes. Mm-hmm. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Well, computers are my forte.
Let me see.